Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to the Gallipoli Club, where Babette Smith makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Many of you know her well, so I will introduce her briefly. She studied arts at Sydney University, went into show business, television production, worked for Hoyts and advertising and marketing, and then marketing on her own for the Festival of Sydney. She was a columnist on Item magazine, but probably best known these days as the author of A Cargo of Women, non-fiction books, Australia's Burstein, Mothers and Sons and Coming Up for Air, and also the novel A Cargo of Women, the novel, but most recently The Luck of the Irish, How a Shipload of Convicts Survived the Wreck of the Hive to Make a New Life in Australia, which is recently being published, and that is why Babette Smith's here tonight. And the topic of the talk to the Sydney Institute tonight at the Gallipoli Club is The Making of the Australian Working Class, an Irish Perspective. Babette Smith, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. I very much appreciate it. The Luck of the Irish begins with the wreck of the convict ship Hive, which ran aground on the coast near Jervis Bay in December 1835. On board were 250 Irish prisoners, 29 soldiers, 8 of them with wives and young children. Commander of the guard was 25-year-old Edward Lugard. This was an interlude for him. He was on his way to rejoin his regiment in India. However, it did allow him to spend time with his younger brother Henry, who just graduated as a Royal Engineer, and New South Wales was his first posting. Thanks to the heroism of the ship's officer, Edward Canning, all of them got safely on shore. But they had little idea where they were, except that after 100-something days at sea, they were still one day's sail from Sydney. They were guided to the nearest European by members of the local indigenous community. In Sydney, they found an Irishman ruling the colony. Richard Bourke had been governor of New South Wales since late 1831. He was a Protestant from Limerick. Bourke was loyally supported by two leading citizens who were also Irish, but they were Roman Catholic. One was John Hubert Plunkett, the Attorney General, and the other Roger Thierry, or Thierry more correctly, a leading barrister. The Sydney Morning Herald liked to sneer at the Irish trio, nicknaming them the O'Connellite Tale, a reference to reformer Daniel O'Connell's successful campaign in Ireland for the emancipation of Catholics. The Luck of the Irish follows many of these people, including Bourke, Henry Lugard, Edward Canning, and Private Patrick Tierney, a soldier who settled with his family in the colony. However, my main interest, as always, was tracing the experience of the convicts and placing them in the broader context of the penal settlement and its aftermath. Three main questions arose from my research. The first came from researching the crimes in Ireland. We usually classify Irish convicts as mainly sheep stealers or property thieves, mixed with some feisty protesters. Statistically, that's not wrong, but statistics can be misleading. My research discovered hair-raising violence, which could be loosely categorised in four groups: political violence, religious violence, tribal violence, and sexual violence. One of the issues of the book is whether that violence was transferred to Australia. A second question related to the wreck. The men plainly weren't scared of bloodshed, and 250 prisoners on that beach was overwhelming numbers compared to 29 soldiers. Why didn't they try to escape? Thirdly, of course, was the question of what happened to them in the penal colony. Not unreasonably, I expected a sorry tale of prejudice, of rampant sectarianism and disadvantage. In other words, a convict colony that was laying the groundwork for the experience of the Irish in Australia as a downtrodden minority in the face of Protestant ascendancy. However, we forget that the history of the Irish was conceptualised by the Roman Catholic Church. My research reveals we cannot be sure how aggrieved Irish prisoners really felt at the lack of priests, because being Catholic became the perfect excuse for escaping compulsory religion. Furthermore, much evidence exists to confirm that whatever their ethnicity, convicts resented divine service as an interruption to their free time. Visiting a pastoral estate on a Sunday, emigrant Alexander Harris commented, quote, "Nobody here keeps the day as anything more than a holiday. Men wash their shirts and grind their wheat and visit each other." To sum up, rather than discrimination, I discovered an Irish community that, thanks particularly to Governor Burke, even achieved religious equality in the 1830s, something I don't think any of us know anything about. But the Irish of the day understood what had happened and valued it. And the statue up the road in front of the State Library is a testimony to their gratitude. We also assume the Irish suffered discrimination in New South Wales because they were an ethnic minority group. However, that assumption fundamentally misreads the dynamics of the convict colony. In those times, the Irish weren't a minority at all. Lumped together with the other convicts, they were part of the majority, the prisoner workforce, whose influences and wishes were so powerful. And it's the workforce I'll focus on tonight. The work of the great Marxist historian E.P. Thompson, called The Making of the English Working Class, suggested the title of tonight's talk. The allusion is, however, more to emphasise difference than similarity. When most of our convicts left Britain, Marx had not yet published his manifesto. The Luddites had protested by smashing things up, but Chartism barely existed, and the English Parliamentary Reform Act of the 30s was of little moment to most people transported to the penal colonies. Craft guilds had begun a transition to trade unions, but the movement was embryonic. However, you do find traces of unionism in penal Australia. A prisoner appointed by his peers to receive their rations was referred to as the delegate. And a carpenter I was tracking from the ship Hive was a unionist transported for throwing acid in the face of a man who hadn't paid his dues. The right to strike, or lack of it, had become notorious in Britain and Ireland after it was banned in 1799, repealed in 1824, and banned again in 1825. But even the bottom layer of British society and in Ireland would have heard something of this. Furthermore, in Australia, there were no middle-class leaders to promote these ideas that had just begun circulating at home. No gentry radicals to conceptualise workforce issues. The workers had to do it for themselves. As a result, our workers' actions contained no cultural deference or respect, but instead expressed the often derisive opposition of a workforce resisting coercion. In Australia, however, we did meet what E.B. Thompson argued was the fundamental requirement for making a class. We had a huge number of people, the majority of the community, in fact, who were bonded by group consciousness. In our case, it was a group who defined themselves as prisoners or ex-prisoners or the children of prisoners. So our workers were not organised by ideas. Their actions arose from the dominance here of the penal workforce. The power of the workers lay in their numbers. The gap between a tiny group of gentry settlers on the one hand and criminals past and present on the other was enormous. The disproportionate numbers on the beach, between 250 prisoners and 29 soldiers, was replicated throughout the penal colony. It's part of the great Australian ignorance of our history that the implication of this is not something we've considered before. True, we've not been helped by official documents. For instance, a decision taken for the 1836 census to describe everyone but serving convicts as free settlers. The total population in 1836 was 77,000. The new form of classification allowed the census takers to claim there were 32,000 free people compared to 45,000 convicts, nearly equal and very misleading. And what about the forces of order, I hear you ask? Well, the top figure for the military in the 30s was 2,835 soldiers in 1837. And they were scattered all over the colony. In 1835, on Norfolk Island, for instance, there were 1,200 prisoners and only 150 soldiers, plus their officers. Reckoning the odds against them, Commandant Joseph Anderson planned to arm the 100 ex-soldier prisoners if it came to another revolt. From 1826, there were small squads of mounted police in addition to the military guard. They were usually ex-soldiers who'd resigned from the army. In 1839, more than a decade later, a border police force was formed to patrol the expanding perimeters of settlement. These were usually ex-convict soldiers. And of course, up to 1850, there were police constables of convict background. Nevertheless, the forces of law and order, even given all these various arrangements, were always vastly outnumbered, and their allegiance was often doubtful. The disproportionate numbers made the settlers afraid. Their situation was like building a house today in a maximum security prison and opening the doors. At a personal level, say a family of five, with say two servants they brought with them from home, would find themselves living with 20 assigned prisoners, a couple of ticket of leave men, and perhaps an emancipist. Emmeline MacArthur described how her father, Hannibal, wouldn't let a convict cross the threshold. He employed domestic servants from India instead. In the Hunter Valley in the 30s, pastoralist Robert Scott greeted visitors with a double-barreled shotgun demanding identification. Some settlers were particularly afraid of the Irish. Illawarra settler Jane Spearing wrote that all his 16 servants were Irish, and he thought they were conspiring against them. And of course, the prisoners could smell his fear. The local magistrate commented, "He's all along been afraid of his men, and they know it." Like Spearing, some settlers saw Irish bogeymen everywhere they looked. They were always expecting a rebellion, particularly by the Irish. When it didn't happen, the gentry had the answer. They told Charles Darwin that the convicts were cowards. Of course, people who said that took no account of the conditions from which the convicts had come. Furthermore, these commentators failed to see the mutiny that was actually occurring, and they missed it because it occurred in the workplace. Official documents might proclaim regulations that create an image of a well-ordered, tightly controlled jail. However, contrary to expectation, it was the convict workers themselves who shaped the structure of their work, many of the conditions of work, and the rewards for work. For example, the tradition of prisoners working for themselves dated back to the early days of settlement. At this time also, they demanded work by task rather than a number of hours. Governor Phillip negotiated with convict agricultural gangs over the amount of work they would complete. His second-in-command, John Hunter, found it necessary to negotiate with his workforce on Norfolk Island about setting task work that the prisoners felt was realistic. Later, when he was governor, Hunter confronted a gang of sawyers at the Hawkesbury settlement who had apparently set their own task work. In his opinion, they'd set it too low because it gave them half a day free each week. But Hunter's real concern was the way they openly bargained with government officials over their reward. For, say, excess labour above their task work, and they also negotiated directly with free settlers on a contract basis. Hunter tried to regain some control by formalising the hours of work and curtailing the prisoner's ability to influence the subject. His lack of success can be seen by the fact that Governor King was still grappling with the problem of a standardised working day in 1801. In Governor Macquarie's time, Major Druitt was responsible for work gangs. He told Royal Commissioner Big in 1819 that he used the task work system because he found it, quote, the best mode of securing the performance of a fair day's work. In the 30s, convict Michael Moran was a skilled carpenter. Theoretically restricted to government work, Moran operated a thriving sideline, making and repairing whatever was needed for Newcastle's leading citizens. He was aggrieved when suddenly told he could not do private work in his own time, and doubly so because he claimed he did it with his overseer James Pumphrey's permission. Pumphrey and the two Newcastle Pumphrey and the two Newcastle gentlemen who'd been utilising Moran's services went into meltdown trying to explain their complicity. Under investigation, Pumphrey told the bench, "It has been my practice to give the good men leave to work in their own time, such as Saturday. They seem to work better for government from these indulgences." In other words, the prisoners had convinced their masters that a carrot was more effective than a stick. Sir Edward Parry, who ran the Australian Agricultural Company, which had a large labour force, wrote, "A convict, unless he's well watched, will not perform the same amount of labour as a free worker, except in the case of what's called task work." Task work enabled the men to work at a pace that allowed time to themselves. And time of their own did not just mean an hour or two after the day's work. It soon extended to the men having one whole day off per week. And in this, their expectation was always assisted by official policy that prisoners should receive the benefit of religion. Although, as we've seen in the men's minds, time to themselves took precedence over religious observances. With the right to a day off established, negotiations occurred over time to entrench two refinements. By 1828, the men constructing the Great Northern Road officially worked only until 2 p.m. on Saturdays and then were taken to a pond or river to bathe and wash their clothes. Sunday remained their day off. Historian Stephen Nicholas drew a comparison with workers elsewhere in the world. He wrote, "The convicts in New South Wales generally laboured 5 days a week to perform an average of 56 hours of work. They worked fewer hours than most coerced, contract and free workers. By comparison, a 6-day working week was the standard for bonded Indians and Spanish and American slaves, and also for free labourers in Britain." Of great significance to Australian history, however, is recognising the extent to which this work structure was achieved by negotiation and pressure from the workers themselves. By the 1830s, the workers were testing the idea of time in lieu if a master's requirement intruded on their free time. In explaining his refusal to work on a Monday, prisoner Edward Gill spoke as though it was a commonplace assumption. "I had been working all week like the rest of the men and took out the sheep on Sunday to oblige my master. On Monday, when I told the overseer I wouldn't work, I thought I had the right to half that day, having been at work all day Saturday." Try as it might, the government never succeeded in ending the day off in attitude or in fact. the practice was still common nearly 50 years after the Europeans arrived. For example, engineer John Busby was asked to explain why his convict miners were picked up drinking in town pubs. This group were building the tunnel from what was then called the Lachlan's Swamps and is today's Centennial Park to Sydney Town. They had proffered the traditional explanation of being on their own time. Busby was asked, is this the practice for prisoners of this department to be allowed the whole of Saturday to themselves? Busby replied hastily, it's not the practice here. Almost certainly he, like many colonial employers, had taken the line of least resistance and turned a blind eye. The prisoners' success regarding task work and working hours are just two examples of their power in the colony. There were many others, wages, for example. Initially, convicts were paid wages only for extra work. Then, for about 10 years, government regulations set a general wage to be paid to them. Under pressure from the prisoners, some employers kept paying the wage, even after the official rate was abandoned. Other employers offered incentives. I found evidence of employers giving sheep or cattle to men who were still serving their sentence. Some men built up large herds, and they were allowed to graze their herds on their master's land. Rations were always a major issue across the convict colony, and it was only sometimes a question of the prisoners being underfed. Just as often, it was the quality of the food that caused strife between master and men, or the provision of tea and sugar, which regulations insisted on describing as privileges. In reality, convicts were addicted to sugar and tea, as only people who'd never had them at home could be. They soon regarded these items as entitlements and would strike if they were not provided. In Australia, men from the lowest socioeconomic level at home developed the confidence to strike for their entitlements and bargain collectively. And they did so while prisoners, decades before the development of trade unions and the arrival of immigrant union leaders. The prisoners, including the Irish, gained this workplace power because the government and the pastoralists needed their help. But the source of their power was their overwhelming numbers and the fear this created in the gentry. The power of the workforce continued throughout the convict era and became a dominant characteristic of Australian society thereafter. And as regards the Irish in the workforce, it's important to understand that the penal colony subsumed difference of race, ethnicity, education and religion. The researcher looks in vain for evidence of discrimination against the Irish. They were equal members of the workforce, sharing its disadvantages, but drawing strength from its collective and power through its numbers. Difficulties experienced by the Irish in obtaining documents such as tickets of leave are no different to convicts of other ethnicity or colour. Their prominence in workplace disputes is equaled by the Scots and the English. Peter Hammond's study of violence in the Hunter Valley found no greater participation by or against the Irish. Tim Corse's research into Norfolk Island established that the proportion of Irish sent there was consistent with their numbers on the mainland. By comparison, however, Sue Rosen found more Irish prisoners labouring on the Bathurst Road, the only significant aberration to the pattern. Most evidence indicates that the penal authorities, whether bureaucrats or magistrates, acted with little regard to whether a prisoner was Irish, Scottish or English, black or white. Their status as a prisoner was far more important. Prejudice, where it did operate, must have occurred at a personal level between individuals. And between the prisoners themselves, differences of race, religion and class were irrelevant in a shared struggle to survive their penal servitude. In 1846, an Irish prisoner could describe Australia as, quote, this comfortable country. In an extraordinary statement, when you think of the sectarianism that developed later and that some of us grew up with, he told Caroline Chisholm, quote, Catholics and Protestants live quiet here. I've never seen a fight between a Protestant and a Catholic over religion. The Irish also benefit from the culture which the prisoners created in the approximately 30 years between the First Fleet and the arrival of free settlers in any significant numbers in the 1820s. During that time, the prisoner colonists became possessive about the society they had created. Traditionally, we've been led to believe that Australians fear foreigners, but examination of our convict years reveal that foreign had nothing to do with it. The convicts feared being overwhelmed by the British class system, which would return them to outcast status. They waged a relentless campaign that forced free migrants to take on the local ethos. New chums, they called them, or more insultingly, self-imported devils. This colonisation process, which could often be harsh or even cruel to newcomers, was well known at the time. James MacArthur commented in 1837, "They feel the colony is theirs by rights, and the emigrant settlers are interlopers." Adopting local ways and leaving the past behind was the sticking point. After all, leaving the past behind included leaving the criminal conviction behind. So that was one of the reasons it became so important. If a newcomer showed willing, he or she was welcome. The Irish prisoners helped to create this ethos because they knew it would help prevent replicating the discrimination that existed in Ireland. Analysis of penal society answers the long-standing question about why the prisoners, specifically the Irish, did not rebel. For all the notorious mutinies on Norfolk Island, Tim Corser found that the men there contested their captors on the ordinary battlefield of day-to-day life. My research concludes that Norfolk Island was a microcosm of what occurred on the mainland. In their way, the male convicts never stopped rebelling, the Irish among them, but their revolution has not been detected because it occurred in the workplace. Some kept hoping for a full-on and bloody revolution. For example, when Frederick Engels heard of trouble on the New South Wales goldfields in 1831, he wrote with great excitement to Karl Marx, predicting, quote, "The British will be thrown out, and the United States of deported murderers, burglars, rapists and pickpockets will startle the world by demonstrating what wonders can be performed by a state consisting of undisguised rascals. They will beat California hollow, but whereas in California rascals are still lynched, in Australia they'll lynch the gentry." In Australia, neither the Irish nor anyone else felt the need to rebel. The gentry had been expecting Engels' lynch mob for years, and the working man already had the power that Marx theorised could only be achieved by bloodshed. Taskwork survived despite endless official pronouncements to the contrary. In the exercise of power, the convicts' weapons were the strike, the go slow, and insisted on penalty rates such as tea and sugar and tobacco, demanding time and lieu for working on Sunday, and in effect negotiating off what became the Great Australian Weekend. By the end of transportation, a work structure was entrenched, which consisted of half-day Saturday and all Sunday to themselves. A strike by convict sawyers, which lasted 3 weeks, revealed that some also deployed the concept of enterprise bargaining. The fact these tactics occurred across the mainland and including Norfolk Island demonstrates the fundamental role they played in the life and culture of the penal colony. In Australia, the Irish working man gained power along with his fellow prisoners. A convict in Western Australia spoke for the rest when he wrote, "The bond class are perfectly conscious of their power and only quiet and orderly because they see there's nothing to be gained by a contrary course." Well, I'd suggest that for many he might have added, "and much to lose." In 1974, Craig McGregor wondered, quote, some of you all know this quote already, "Why do the wealthy feel under some pressure to be accepted by ordinary working Australians rather than the other way round?" Convict Australia provides the answer. The nub of our famous egalitarianism is not based on the usual markers of education or money or birth or religion. It's not limited to the superficiality of manners, but something far more profound. Unlike other societies where a faux equality of manners might be granted from above, Australian egalitarianism rests on the attitude and self-belief of the workers. The prisons made a whole community in their image rather than just a working class. Thank you.
Many thanks to Babette Smith. Janet Grundy's got some copies of The Luck of the Irish, and I'm sure our author would be happy to sign any after the event. I think she signed some before the event. So now we go to questions and discussion, and you can come back now. That was a terrific presentation, and I guess what I was thinking about as you gave it was who you didn't talk about. I mean, as you know, Robert Hughes's famous book, The Fatal Shore, presents itself as a book of history. In fact, it's really a book of penology. It's all about solitary confinement and the lash and the penal settlement. But what you're talking about here is convicts who quickly move into our society, who make a contribution to our society, who don't want to go home. So this is quite a rival interpretation of the first 30, 40, 50 years of the settlement here.
Yes, it is, but there is supporting evidence from other historians who've been adding bits and pieces to this story, but not put it all together until this book. Last time I was here, I think it was, Gerard, I described The Fatal Shore as an interesting melodrama, and I still feel that way, although he writes beautifully in places. It doesn't help us understand our first 60 to 80 years.
But if you're if you're coming to Australia from London or New York and you go into a bookshop, that's the book you'll find, isn't it?
I know. He was a great publicist, and of course he was based in New York, and it was published all around the world while the rest of us struggled to get published, even in Britain and Ireland.
Right, there's a question here.
Yes, yesterday, I think on the radio, I heard someone say that political prisoners from Ireland were settled somewhere up there or in prison, up near Ryde and that part, and they were forbidden to have any marriage or sexual relationships with any white people in the colony, and therefore tended to marry Aborigines. And he said there was a lot of Aboriginal people who were Aboriginal plus Irish up in that area.
The suggestion that the Irish in Ryde were not allowed to marry into white society and therefore married into Aboriginal society. Right.
Well, I don't know what to say. Who on earth was that? I've never seen any evidence for that at all. And the Irish weren't forbidden to marry, say, other white people that were Scots or English. In fact, they did marry the Scots and the English.
It's one of those programs they're having now about Aborigines, just week,
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, I've not seen any evidence for it, and I've researched convict society in a lot of depth. And one of the things that is striking during that first 6 years is the ecumenical nature of it. Not just the workforce, but the gentry were intermarrying. And say somebody as famous as, well, to some of us famous, Terence Murray, who was a Roman Catholic pastoralist who bought Yarralumna. He married a Church of England woman, and the service was in the Church of England. The second marriage, which probably reflects what was happening in the time in the wider society, he married again in about 1860. They had two services, one in the Roman Catholic Church and one in the Church of England.
There's a question here.
This may be a silly question. Refer to them as convicts.
Yes.
Is there a difference?
No, they're the same.
So the terms prisoner and convicts are the same?
Yes, they're interchangeable.
Make sure we're picking up on our podcast. Okay, there's a question.
Right. I thought your presentation was fantastic.
Thank you.
In my dotage, I've been doing a master's in colonial history, and I happen to be related to that terrible man who built the Busby Bore.
Oh.
And he had a son who was a doctor later at Bathurst, but he was in Norfolk Island. so he had that problem. You didn't distinguish between imprisonment, say, in Norfolk Island, which I understand was a secondary punishment,
yes,
and the naughty, naughty ones. But my question, though, is a little different. My question is that the people who were otherwise privileged, I think that they need praise because they accepted people who weren't privileged. And we have a great society because we are unlike the societies we came from.
The suggestion is that the privileged willingly accepted those who were not privileged.
Look, it varied. There were some people that maintained all the prejudices of the gentry class towards the workers. But there were some wonderful examples of ecumenical behaviour. For instance, the St Patrick's Day dinner that began to develop from the mid-1820s on. There were no gentry having a formal St Patrick's Day dinner until it started around about 1826. And initially it was Catholics. And then the Chief Justice Dowling, who was a Protestant Irishman, he went. And then Alexander Maclay, who was a Scot and a Protestant, if ever there was one, he went. And so all the leading citizens of the colony were celebrating St Patrick's Day by 1830. Of course, once the churches flooded in about 1840, it started to fall apart and become sectarian again.
So there's a question down here. Don't stand in front of the camera, yep? Let's speak up a bit.
Could you give us an example of a task?
An example of a what?
A task.
A task. How long would a general task take of a convict?
I can't give you a lot of detailed knowledge on that, but as I understand it, agricultural labourers, if they were bringing in a harvest, would undertake to bring in so many bushels. And you know how they used to wrap wheat in sort of, I don't know what you call them, but you'd see them. Yes. So that they would have argued, you know, well, we'll do 25 today or we'll do 50 or whatever. That's the best example I can give you, but that's going a bit beyond my expertise and the records.
Don't let that worry you. You won't be the first person who has done that. Down the back. Yeah.
What percentage of the population were women in, say, 1830?
What percentage of the population were women in 1830?
Oh, God. It was very small. There was always a big discrepancy between the men and women, although more wives came out than we tend to think about. I can't tell you precisely if the 1836 census was 77,000 people, the number of women was probably roughly 7,000. It was very small. Mm. But the convicts were very young. That's the other thing that we don't understand. There were more married men from Ireland, but generally speaking, the convicts ranged between 15 and about 22. So you have to understand how young they were. And, of course, if you think about one of the statistics that existed is the vast number of children that were born because their parents were eating better and living better generally. And so, particularly in the early years, this works where a couple of men who came out in the same ship, one of them would be lucky enough to find a female partner or marry and have children. The other one would wait 15 years and marry one of the daughters. And that kind of thing was going on all the time.
I just wanted to know, there being only 10% who were white women, whether there wasn't a good deal of marriage with a formalised or not with Aboriginal?
There was, but it's very hard to document. Relations, I think Grace Karskin showed in her book, relations between the Europeans and the Aborigines were much, much more nuanced in that early colonial period than we've understood. That's not to deny there were massacres and killings, but also there were good relationships. there's quite a lot of interesting work for going on now further into that question to get our head around more detail.
The Irish rebellion at Quakers Hill or thereabouts, is that an aberration or is that something?
It was an aberration, really. It was 1804, I think, was the date. The men caught up in it, and by the way, there were 300 English prisoners involved in that too. They
this
were
going back Quakers Hill. Right,
yes, the 18 the Irish Rebellion. The men who were caught up in that and led it were the failed rebels of the 1798 rebellion back in Ireland. And they didn't leave the past behind. They brought the grief and the passion of that with them. And the few years after their arrival were quite turbulent, and the two governors around at that time, Hunter and King, really did think there was going to be an Irish rebellion. However, somebody who specialises in that period, whose name is Marianne Whittaker, she followed that all through and looked at those who, you know, stayed after that rebellion. By 1810, they'd all become members of the community. One of their number, James Meehan, was in effect surveyor general for the colony because his superior was sick and absent for a long time. Meehan discovered that the soil down Campbelltown way was particularly fertile. And he persuaded many of those Irish rebels to go and settle as farmers in the Campbelltown area. And that led to a general, almost chain migration of Irish people to that area and pushing out further later through Goulburn, Yass, Boorah, and down on the coast to the Illawarra, whereas the Hunter was a bit of a hotbed of Protestantism. So.
Protestant, Catholic and Irish. How Irish were the Protestant Irish? I mean, essentially they're Anglo-Irish, and some of the Catholic Irish would have said they weren't really Irish at all. They would have said they're English living in Ireland. I mean, was there much tension between those two brands of Irish as to who was really Irish?
Not really. That kind of thing didn't translate to Australia, and particularly during those years. Later in the 19th century, there might have been more evidence of that, but it's not obvious convict years.
It's about that time of your writing of that Caroline Chisholm's movement to bring women to the colony gets up. How important was that in these kind of settlers that you're talking about, the aspirational former convicts? To what extent did they push that sort of movement?
Well, first of all, you have to acknowledge that the British themselves started a reunion scheme. Initially, it was informal, and they would put large groups, some of them were 120 women and children, on convict ships coming out to the colony from really the early 1800s. Then they began to formalise it from 1817. And by the 1830s and 40s, which was the height of the convict era when the most convicts were arriving, the reunion scheme was well underway. Many wives and children arrived that way. Some still came on female convict ships. Caroline Chisholm came into the middle of that, and most particularly, the British wanted to save some money once transportation ended to New South Wales in 1840. So they decided they'd abandon the reunion scheme. And there were convicts that had applications in the system, were waiting to hear about whether their families would come out. Caroline Chisholm was very instrumental in picking up the slack there. She actually went to England just around the time that Earl Grey was having political difficulties about sending more convicts to Australia anyway. And one of the bargaining chips he was using was, well, I'll send free immigrants as well. And Caroline Chisholm went over and happened to arrive at the very moment that that was under discussion and managed to get the scheme restarted. And in the interim, during the 2 or 3 years while there was no scheme, she managed to get wives and families of convicts onto convict ships that were still going to Tasmania. And then she would arrange for those wives and families to get on a local boat and come up to Sydney. So as a facilitator, she was very important. She didn't invent the scheme, but she made it work, and she picked up the slack when the British abandoned it.
Question here. Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to read your book, and I'd like to congratulate you very sincerely. I'd like you just to talk a little bit about how you gathered together the stories of so many families. They were marvellous, and I'm sure people will be able to look through it and find their own families represented.
The question is, how did you gather together information of so many families? What was the process and suggestion that some of the people around would be related to those families?
Well, for a researcher of me, like me, you get a sample of people. And in my case, it's usually off a boat. And there are some places you go first, in official documents, in the archives. You go to that ship's indent that lists everyone on board and gives a lot of detail about them, such as date of trial and where their native place and age and so on. But there is a limit to which a scholar can take individual stories, and that's where the scholarship of family historians come in, because the scholar's working forward, but the family historian's working backwards, and they know how the story ends. So I've been very fortunate, really, with all my books, even Cargo of Women, the first one, which included a relative of mine, that family historians, when they hear I'm writing one, they get in touch, and they've usually done some wonderful research, which is very valuable. For instance, there was Barry James. Where are you, Barry? Yes, there he is. He has an ancestor who was an overseer, ex-army man, a pensioner, brought out with others to be overseers in the colony here. And Barry's done a lot of work on that. And if you've read The Luck of the Irish, the man's name is William Branch, you'll know that he's very significant to the story. He didn't have a wonderful career in the colony, but I think Governor Burke helped him leave Norfolk Island behind, where he'd been an overseer. But when 10 years after Burke had left, they were raising money for a statue of Burke. William Branch, a Protestant, donated a shilling. And so that statue up the road at the library, there was a big procession along Macquarie Street, and the band was playing, and Governor Gipps was unveiling the statue. And Burke had sat for the statue over in Limerick in retirement, so it's true to life. And the unfortunately, by then, sectarianism had raised its ugly head. None of the Protestants would attend the parade, but there were hordes of Catholic children. And anyone who donated to the statue could be amongst the people in the parade. So I'm sure William Branch was there, Barry.
How consistent is this picture around the other colonies? I'm thinking of Western Australia, you mentioned Tasmania.
Well, sorry.
And Moreton Bay.
Moreton Bay I know least about, because the least research has been done on that so far. Somebody's now done Norfolk Island from the original primary sources rather than regurgitating stuff from official papers and so on, as Robert Hughes did, for instance. I did 4 boats for Australia's birthday, one in 1817, whose men went here and down to Tasmania, one here in 1832 at the height of the system, a late one down in Tasmania, and one in the middle over in Western Australia. The picture is pretty consistent, actually. Individual aspects of it change. For instance, flogging diminished, because by now the penal reformers back in Britain had got on to the cruelty of flogging and had invented solitary confinement. Now, there is evidence from the prisoners in various sources that they loathe solitary confinement, and they'd rather have a flogging and get it over with. So again, you've got to analyse the sources and try and put yourself in the place of the prisoners to understand that point of view. But anyway, for that reason, penal reform, flogging did diminish.
Very quick now, we're getting to the end. Question here? Yeah.
The famine seems to have had a strong, my impression, effect on American history. Did it have the same sort of effect on Australia?
The Irish famine had a big impact on American history. What about Australian history?
Well, bear in mind, all the people I'm talking about had not experienced the famine. They'd left before that happened. Yes, of course, we had an influx of people because of the famine. But I don't think we've made as much of it as the Americans did. And that may be explicable by this leave the past behind ethos, whereas the Americans do emphasise it much more. But yes, we had our share of people who'd been badly affected by the famine and the years that followed.
Patrick O'Farrell makes a point in his History of the Australian Catholic Church that the immigrants that came to Australia from Ireland had to have a little bit more in their pocket. They had to be able to prepare for a much longer journey. They had to have the money to pay for the sort of things they needed for that. So it's possible that our famine wasn't quite what the American was, American immigrant from Ireland was, because I imagine the famine would have left people without the wherewithal to make the long journey to Australia. It would be interesting to see how much we were affected by the immigrants because of the famine, because it was a long way to come, and to get to America was much easier.
Yes, well, we really, as always, even in the 20th century, attracted our immigrants by subsidising the passage. And that was true right back in the 19th century. However, as I understand it, also the parishes in Ireland would raise money or provide clothes to help people get to wherever the embarkation point was. So that was one reason it happened. But I don't think I've got anything more to add to that. That's about right.
This is a final question. You're presenting a society that's, in the time you're writing about, in the early days of settlement, that's very pragmatic and accepting of others and accepting of difference and a desire just to get along to make things work, I guess. But within about 80 years' time, by the end of the 19th century, you've got a society where there's a fair degree of sectarianism which runs on beyond that. So much so that some people thought there was more sectarianism in Melbourne than there was in Dublin, in for the Irish, the English leadership in Dublin in the early 20th century. What do you think changed along the way? What happened to the children and grandchildren of this group?
Yes, I'm very glad you asked that, because I hadn't found an opportunity to give those details. Governor Burke's great gift to the Irish in the colony was what's called the Church Act, which Patrick O'Farrell didn't touch once. It's nowhere in his book. That was passed in 1836, and it was Burke's aim to make sure that the disadvantage of the Irish in religion and education was not replicated here. The Church Act prevented the Church of England becoming an established church, put the Irish Roman Catholic Church on equal terms with the Church of England, because the legislation provided funds to bring out clergy and to build churches. The Methodists, Congregationalists and the Jews were also to be included in that act, but in order to get it through, Burke had to cut them out, but Plunkett got them in. Three years later he got the Methodists and the other dissenters in, and the Jews got in under this legislation about 10 years later. The unintended consequence of this very good act was, unfortunately, by tying the funding to the churches and the number of parishioners they had, it set off the most dreadful sectarian battle between the churches. And that led to the kind of entrenched sectarianism that we recognise from well into the 20th century. Sadly, because it was a great thing. But just briefly, we did have one long-term benefit. You can look at our constitution, section 116, which is the one that deals with religion and says there'll be no state religion and so on. It's like an echo of the Declaration of the Catholic Association in Ireland in the 1820s, which said there will be no state religion, all of them will be on equal standing. And John Hubert Plunkett was a member of the Catholic Association. Burke was in South Africa at the time, but Plunkett would have been at that for certain.
After the luck of the Irish, what's next?
I've got one. Some of you will know the work of Samuel Thomas Gill, the artist of the Goldfields, he's usually known as. Well, if you go online to the Australian Dictionary of Biography, you'll find him described as the son of a respectable Baptist minister who emigrated to South Australia. Well, I found that he was a baby convict transported here aged 13 for forgery. So, it adds a whole new dimension to his work. He had a rotten time, so it's actually a tragic story. But
you have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you
to the
support
Club
of Microsoft Australia.
And the facilities here
are
still
listening.
And thanks to
Bette
Smith for another entertaining and very informative address to the Sydney Institute, her work comes out of a lot of research and very considered, as you'll note, and an important contribution to the understanding of the early years of settlement in Australia. So, to Bette Smith, well done tonight, and no doubt we'll have you back with your next endeavour sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thanks.